evolution really is about illusions. It's about how you can make somebody believe something's true when there's absolutely no data. There's no actual data that you're looking at it. So it's all make-believe. Tonight, we're going to focus on two things as we study. The first thing we're going to focus on is we're going to answer the question, why is it that intelligent people choose to believe in something for which there's no evidence that it ever happened? And we're going to answer that first. And then the second thing we're going to do is we're going to look at how you can use the techniques or tools of science for you to see, to learn to see creation every day of your life. Are you ready for that? Okay, well, let's go. Let's start by just sort of building this idea up. And let me just tell you a story about when I first built my first house. Has anybody ever built their own house? I didn't actually build it, but I had someone do it. It was Ryland Homes. And when I went to build it, I used to love to drive from work. I worked at Wright-Patterson's, where the Air Force Research Labs was. That's where I worked. And we would drive out there, and the first thing they did was they dug a big hole, and that you see up here, they put the foundations in, and then they put the concrete around it. And that was to serve as the foundation of the house. Interestingly enough, when the house was built, you no longer saw the foundation, right? It's gone. You never know it's there, but the house sits right on the foundation. Let me share with you something. That a worldview, if you will, a paradigm, is like the foundation of a house. It sits underneath your life. It's basically the hinges that your life turns on. You don't realize it, but inside of if every one of you, you have these presuppositions or worldviews about how the world exists or what something should be like. And all of these worldviews essentially make a big difference in how you live your life. So the question we're going to answer is, what is your worldview when it comes to origins tonight? So the hook that we're going to look at is this hook that's swimming in the waters of our culture that says there is no evidence for creation. You can imagine that's what they say. Oh, there's no evidence for creation. Why do they say that? Here's why. It's because of their worldview, and it's called the worldview of naturalistic philosophy. Naturalistic philosophy, and we'll talk about what that is. But let's look at the first word tonight coming from Harvard professor Dr. Richard Lewontin as he explains why it is he believes in evolution. He says, "Our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance in the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories." That's like evolution, right? Darwinian evolution is an unsubstantiated just-so story. "Because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism." And I'll talk about that in just a second. "It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by an a priori adherence to material causes," and here's why, "to create an apparatus of investigation, a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door." Now, I know he said a lot of things, but really it's kind of interesting. When I was at the University of Mainz looking at the fossils, when I went over to look at the fossil case and I saw a skull that looked just like a cat, you know, like a lion or a cougar, I went over and looked really closely, and it had these weird names there, you know, Zibblabadoobigaba, you know, what in the world's that? So I went over and I grabbed one of the attendants that worked in the thing, and she came over and we looked. I said, what? That looks just like a cougar skull. And she says, it is a cougar skull. But why does it have the weird name there? Well, she said, well, it's supposed to have been evolved, and it's supposed to be millions of years old, so they can't put cougar skull. And it's the same thing what we're going to be learning tonight about naturalistic philosophy and materialism. They can't just come out and say, well, we're atheists, and our religion is atheism, which means you can't have God, no God. So instead, they come up with some fancy words that describe the apparatus for which they believe. You know, in other words, it's the foundation of their worldview. It's their worldview of life, and it's the foundation, and they have fancy names for. In other words, everything I'm going to share with you is atheism, okay, or secular humanism, whichever one of those religions you want. But the two names that they use to describe it is called naturalistic philosophy and materialism. You see, materialism is simply how you apply naturalistic philosophy. And if you really want to understand, you know, kind of the philosophy kind of stuff, you have to understand circular reasoning. You know, circular reasoning is you state basically your proof and your proposition and in your proof, you know, all the way through. You state the thing over and over again, but you never actually show how it's true. That's circular reasoning. And this is naturalistic philosophy. Basically what they say is, well, nature is all that I see, therefore, you know, nature must be all that there is, right? That's kind of their philosophy. Well, nature is all that I see, so nature is all that there is. That means, you know, in other words, they exclude everything outside. Well, where did nature come from? Well, you can't talk about that, because I can't see that. Well, where did all the natural laws come from? Well, you can't talk about that, because I can't see that. What about all the fine tunings that we have? And, you know, like in the gravitational fields and gravity and electromagnetics. Oh, you can't talk about that because I can't see that. Well, could there be a designer? Well, I can't talk about that because I can't see that. So in other words, it completely shuts down the argument and says, look, we're atheists. It basically, if you want to get the bottom line, we're atheists. We don't believe in anything. We don't believe in the supernatural. You can't have a God come in and design anything or make anything. Bottom line. And that's essentially what their philosophy is. Interestingly enough, Professor Philip Johnson in his book Darwin on Trial writes that without Darwinism, see, Darwinism is a materialistic explanation. It's actually one of the little tools in their toolbox. Without it, scientific naturalism, which is another word for this, would have no creation story. They wouldn't have a story to tell if without Darwin's story. And so they love that. You know, he writes, Although most people believe that an enormous amount of empirical evidence supports the general theory of evolution, this is in fact an illusion. Most people in the intellectual world are certain that evolution must be true because it's the only tenable, naturalistic, read atheistic, explanation for the development of complex life. You get it? Or life in general, and therefore it must be true if non-naturalistic explanations such as creation are ruled ineligible for consideration. Oops, you can't get in the door, sorry. And then the evidence is built up upon pre-existing theoretical certainty based upon philosophical presupposition. So in other words, what's happening in our world today is philosophy is running science. Science is no longer, when it comes to origins, they're completely unwilling to look at what's really happening in our world because they're so certain that it has to be something that cannot have a designer in the picture. He says, non-evolutionary explanations of the evidence are not considered, and therefore evidentiary support, which seems to exist, is the product of cultural certainty rather than its cause or support. So in other words, the whole thing is circular. They can, you know, they continue this whole ball rolling, and they never stop, and they never look at anything else because their philosophy tells them they can't. You know, Dr. William Dubinsky, he writes, he's got a PhD in physics and in mathematics. He says, we are dealing here with something more than straightforward determination of scientific facts or confirmation of scientific theories. Rather, we're dealing with competing worldviews and incompatible metaphysical systems, meaning philosophical systems. So what he's saying is when it comes to origins, we're not talking about science anymore. We're not talking about empirical science. We're talking about philosophy, worldviews. You know, this is my worldview. I'm an atheist, and this is how life has got to be for me. And so, but today, the people who have power in science are the atheists. That's the way it is. He writes, in the creation-evolution controversy, we are dealing with a naturalistic metaphysics. He's talking about naturalistic philosophy. That shapes and controls what theories of biological origins are permitted on the playing field in advance of any discussion or weighing of any evidence. In other words, they're in control. They're atheists. This is the worldview we've got. This is the philosophy we have. Nothing else is allowed to play. He writes, this metaphysics is so pervasive and powerful that it not only rules alternative views out of court, but it cannot even allow it to be criticized of itself. In other words, there's no way you can come in and criticize. You can't stand up and say, teacher, you can't stand there and say the emperor has no clothes. In other words, you can't do it because they won't allow it. And what are we left with? Because science today is run, in origins, is run by people who basically have this worldview that they're telling us that nature itself can create complex things like you and I by accident using processes that they claim can do it, which we know from yesterday that they cannot because science tells us they cannot. What we're left with is a world where nature now, Mother Nature, is this new pagan god. And that's what we have in our world today. Let's go back and look what Dr. Lewontin said, and I'll show you. He says, our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense. And of course, we know that it is against common sense. The patented absurdity of some of its constructs. The failure to fulfill its extravagant promises. Remember, we looked yesterday at the data, and we were supposed to find all these intermediates in the fossil record, and we didn't find them, did we? How about the tolerance in the scientific community of these unsubstantiated little stories? These little stories, little myth stories that they're telling our children. You know, the little book now that they're putting in every the kindergarten age classroom, where they open it up and they show, these things morphing into each other. Little storybooks that they put in there. They're tolerating that. And this is really the bottom line. He says, it's not that the methods or the institutions of science somehow compel us. You see, science never can compel you to do something like this, to accept the material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by an a priori adherence to material causes to create something, to create an apparatus, a system, if you will, of investigation, a set of concepts that will only produce materialistic explanations. And so really what materialism is, if you want to know the bottom line, it's a scientific theory, but basically what it is that it produces explanations for the phenomenal world that only atheists or secular humanists would agree with. You get it? That's really what materialism is. You, no matter what investigation it is, no matter what the subject is, you have to produce an explanation that an atheist or a secular humanist would agree with, and that's just the bottom line. That's materialism. Let me give you an example. Let's talk about prayer. How many of you pray? Yeah, we didn't pray before we started. Maybe we should. But prayer, I know from a person who does pray that God exists and God hears my prayers. I've had prayers answered. I've felt the very presence of God praying. And I know that this is real. But how would a scientist, an atheist, a secular humanist, how would they apply a materialistic explanation for that? I mean, they shouldn't even be monkeying there, right? But they do. Let me give you an example. This is an evolutionist. It's a man named E.O. Wilson. He writes in a book from Harvard University Press, he says, on human nature, he says, the highest form of religious practice, when examined more closely, can be seen to confer biological advantage. Did you see that? He now took something and made a materialistic explanation for it. Completely unfounded, no science there. All he did was he said, okay, somebody's praying. Well, there must be an explanation for that. I'll give you an example. This is so widespread in our world that it constantly is popping up in our culture. Time magazine is probably one of the magazines that really sponsors this kind of thinking the most. They came out with an article, and it's right on this cover here. It's called The God Gene, right? Why are people religious? And atheists want to know. And so what do? They say, well, we're going to go over here and explain why people are religious. You can see it right here. Does our DNA compel us to seek a higher power? Believe it or not, some scientists say yes. Plus a quiz. You know, you get to take a little quiz. The point here is, this is a materialistic explanation for something. Isn't that right? Are you getting this? Do you see it? Do you see how this works? This is how science works now, when the worldview underneath it is naturalistic philosophy that then applies that to make an apparatus to create materialistic explanations, which means explanations that only atheists and secular humanists are comfortable with. And that's how our world works today. That's how science works today and our culture works today. You know, I believe that thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's daughter. But that's not how evolutionists see it. There's a book that they wrote called The Natural History of Rape, Thornhill and Palmer, and it's the biological basis of sexual coercion. And here's what they conclude. Rape is an evolutionary adaptation that permits men unsuccessful in marriage to propagate their genes. What do you think about that? See, this is a materialistic explanation. This is how it works today in the world of naturalistic philosophy, in the world of materialism, atheism controlling all of science today. This is what you're going to get. Now, this guy here, Dr. Michael Ruse, is an interesting character because he's an atheist and an evolutionist, and he's the guy that the lawyers call on when there are school boards, like in Kansas, that want to try to put stickers in their books that say evolution is just a theory, or they'd like to try to teach something besides evolution, you know, they call on this guy, and he comes there and he testifies about how great evolution is and how terrible everything else is. Listen to what this guy says. This is in Thomas Woodward's book, Doubts About Darwin. He writes, he says, evolution, akin to religion, involves making certain a priori metaphysical assumptions, which at some level cannot be proven empirically. Now, we saw that yesterday. It can't be proven at all. Isn't that right? Scientifically, it's not true. Evolution is promoted by its practitioners as more than mere science. Evolution is promulgated as an ideology, a secular religion, a full-fledged alternative to Christianity with meaning and morality, and you just saw the morality. Evolution is a religion. It was true of evolution in the beginning, and it is true of evolution still today. And this is a fact, friends. You see, when you're looking at this, at the world of science today, kind of like broadly, and you're looking at the government and our culture, the worldview, the foundation that's underneath the house there is naturalistic philosophy and materialism, which is another word for atheism and secular humanism. It's a religious. You know, I want to share with you, if you're a young person today, and, you know, you're going to be in a world that's saturated with this atheism. You're going to be, a young person wants to fit in, don't they? You want to feel like you're part of the crowd. But the crowd's watching Bill Maher, you know, and they're listening to he's the country's number one atheist, right? And they're listening to Bill Nye, the science guy, proselytize atheism and evolution. They're listening to Sir Richard Dawkins and these various people. And so, they come over to you and say, you mean you believe in this? You know, and they make you feel bad. But, you know, you got to understand, these people are simply puppets of people who have a worldview that's atheism. But, you know, the Bible talks about this. Romans chapter 1, verse 18 to 25, it says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and righteousness of men who suppress the truth about creation in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them. God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. So they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man, of birds and of four-footed animals and crawling creatures and human philosophies. Therefore, God gave them over to the lust of their hearts and to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Actually, it's the lie. And worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. This is exactly what's happening in our world today. They may not be using real idols today that they worship, but they're actually worshiping, they're worshiping the creation, Mother Nature. Essentially, what we have is that we have Father Time, we have the demigod natural selection, and then we have this ultra-god random mutation. And these are the idols. They claim that they have the ability to see ahead, to add information to the genetic code to make one kind of life morph into another kind of life. That's their just-so story. And as a result, they're turning the whole world into pagans. I'll give you an example of this. In February of 2011, in The Economist magazine, I had that a magazine, I just happened to get this, they had an article in there called Paleontology, Splay-footed but not Flat-footed. And it was all about this thing right up here. What we see up here is it's sort of like a cricket, but it's not, because it's a carnivorous. And you can see here, there's the fossil of it, and then there's the actual one that exists today, just a picture of it. I cannot pronounce that. You try it, but don't say it too fast. Yeah, it's pretty tough. But here's the article. Are you ready for the article? The article, all whole thing was this guy was writing a story about, you know, they're claiming this thing's a million years old, 100 million years old. And the whole article was like, but why hasn't it evolved? It's 100 million years old. They claim that human evolution from an ape to a human was only 5 million. This is 100 million years old, I guess, you know. And so why didn't it evolve? And at the very end of the article, he has this really interesting thing to say. He says, well, the first rule of natural selection is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Now, I got to ask. I read that article. I thought, okay, how does because natural selection is a real ecological process, but it's unguided, it's completely random. How does a unguided, random process know that something's broken? How does an unguided, random process know how to fix it if it is broken? See, what's happening here is that this foundational worldview of atheism, which the fancy names is naturalistic philosophy and materialism, this worldview that's starting to permeate in our culture is turning us into idiots. It's turning us into pagans, where we'll now go out and we'll worship nature, believing that nature can do these things, when in fact it cannot. You know, Dr. William Dubinsky, again, he writes in his book, Intelligent Design, he says, although in ancient times graven images were the most obvious region of idolatry, sign of idolatry, idolatry is not so much a matter of investing any particular object with extraordinary significance, rather it is a matter of investing the world with a significance it does not deserve. That's the essence of idolatry. And today we really are in a culture of idolatry, just like what we read. And so this answers the question as to why it is that smart people believe something for which there's no evidence. It's because it's their philosophy. And they're just not going to look at anything else. That's just how it works. But you can, and I'm going to show you how today. We're going to spend a few minutes here. We're going to do an experiment tonight together. And we're going to learn how you can see creation every day of your life. Now, the one thing that we know about creation is this. If creation was the first cause, now that's the first cause of everything. It would be the first cause of the natural laws that exist, the electromagnetism, gravity, the things that hold the atoms together. It's also the first cause of all the life that we have on this planet, the prototypes that were developed that then were, that they basically, after their kind, they reproduced. the natural laws, and the design. You know, when you think about creation, you have to think about design. How many of you have ever made anything? Anybody? Yeah. What did it look like when you were done? Did it look like it was designed? I bet it did. You know, most people can see something that's made and think, wow, this is designed, like this right here. Did this happen by accident? Or was this put together by design? You know, we can look at that and say, well, we know that was designed. There's no accident there. And the text we just read actually gives us the clue to how to know how to see creation. Right here, Romans 1:20. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. So they are without excuse. Therefore, that tells me that by looking, we should be able to see the thumbprint of our designer. Don't you think? So I'm going to show you two ways you can see the thumbprint of your designer. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to look at sciences that actually look for a designer. Do you know that there are sciences out there that look for a designer? I'll give you an example. Forensic science, right? This is a science where they want to know, were the chips at the door made by an axe or by an accident? Right? There's artificial intelligence. There's the Turing test that wants to know, if is this computer like a human or not? I mean, is this designed, or is this a computer? Or is it a real person? I mean, there are tests that go on like that right now, because robotics is probably one of the biggest fields in the world. Cryptography is another example of a science that looks for a designer. Is this a bunch of random numbers, or is this have meaning? Another one would be archaeology that looks in the past, they're digging through the dirt, looking, is this the sign of an early stone tool? What is this? They're looking for something that came from a designer, a real person. And finally, if you can call it a science, I'll put this on here, SETI, which is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. They also use tools of science to look for a designer. They're looking for somebody out there that has designed something, that shows that they have designed. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to teach you today two of the most important scientific principles that all five of these use in their work. Are you ready? Would you like to learn that? Okay, let's look. The first one is complexity. Complexity. And when I say complexity, I'm not talking about snowflakes. You know, snowflakes come about by natural processes, and they look very complex, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about something like dirt. You know, dirt is got lots of different components in it, and that makes it look complex. But that's not what I'm talking about. Crystals is another example of something that can form. It looks like it might have been made, but it's been formed by natural processes. I'm not talking about that. When scientists talk about complexity, this is what they're talking about. By complexity, we refer to elements that must depend on each other in order to function properly, and not just a lot of unrelated parts. And so when you think of complexity, think of things that have to work together in order for them to actually function. I'll give you an example. This is a website. You know this website? Sure. You know that if you go to a web browser and you put this in www.google.com and you press enter, what will it do? It'll bring up the search engine. Well, no, you already have that open, but it'll bring up the web page. It says Google, right? The search engine, thank you. Now, if I put this in there, will it work? Why not? It's the exact same characters. I didn't change. I have all the same characters. Why won't it work? It's not in the right order. So this means that this depends, even though it has the same characters, it depends on the exact order for it to function. Isn't that right? That's an example of complexity. In fact, that's called specified complexity. It's even a more rigid form of complexity. And so you get an idea what I mean by complexity. Only this one will actually get you where you need to go. And so this is an example of a complex system. Now, this is really interesting. Dr. Dubinsky tells us this. He says, complexity and probability vary inversely. The greater the complexity, the smaller the probability. So if something is very, 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 very complex, then the probability of it just coming about by a chance is very, 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 very small. And what that means is that you can use complexity as a way of seeing creation. I'll give you an example. According to Dr. Dubinsky, in mathematics, one chance in 10 to the 50th power is an impossibility. And what that means is that's 1 divided by 10 to the 50th. That's such a small number, right? It's a 0.049 and a 1. That's a lot of numbers, right? It'd take a long time to write that. And so according to mathematics, that's an impossibility. In other words, it can't happen if it, you know, it's impossible. And that's what it looks like in probability, 10 to the minus 50th. Let's go now and let's bring back Sir Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, proselytizer of evolution and atheism. In his book, he wrote a book called The Blind Watchmaker. He says this: in our theory of how we came to exist, we are allowed a postulate, a certain ration of luck. You know, they're allowed to postulate something. Suppose we wanted to suggest, for instance, that life began when both DNA and its protein-based replication machinery spontaneously chanced to come into existence. We can allow ourselves the luxury of such an extravagant theory, provided that the odds against this coincidence occurring on a planet do not exceed 100 billion billion to one. So what does this guy just do? This guy basically just said, for spontaneous generation to have actually occurred, probability-wise, it can't be a probability that exceeds that amount. And I'll put it up here. You know, basically what he's doing, he's setting the bounds on chance. For mathematics, an impossibility is 10 to the minus 50th, excuse me, one chance in 10 to the 50th. For Dawkins, if I understand his math correctly, it's one chance in 10 to the 20th. So for Dawkins, he's saying, well, look, you know, if the probability is so small, one chance in 10 to the 20th, that this could ever happen, then guess what? It never happened. And so really, for this atheist, this should be setting the boundary on design. And as I was looking at that, I said to myself, wait a minute. I bet you, even me, I could do a little experiment that he could do to prove whether he's right or not. And I thought, well, let's do it tonight. Let's do a little experiment. Let's look at what it would take to make a protein. You know, a protein, let's do a review, okay? You ready? Here we go. Atoms are the basic unit of matter, right? Atoms, helium, hydrogen. Molecules are specific arrangements of atoms. H2O, two hydrogens, one oxygen. Amino acids are specific arrangements of molecules. And finally, proteins are specific arrangements of amino acids. So this is kind of how it all would look. But interesting thing about proteins are that you are essentially proteins. I talked to a biologist who told me that the DNA that's in your body basically unfurls. They have little machines that read it, and they make proteins that make you. Proteins consist of different amino acids. They're linked together in long chains. There are trillions of them in living things. And here's some examples, like your hair is a protein, hemoglobin in your blood, your insulin. Everything about you is basically a protein, and it comes from that manufacturer. Proteins, then, are the building blocks of life. But what's interesting about proteins is that, excuse me, about the amino acids that make the proteins, is that they're, out of all of them that exist, only 20 of them actually are used in living things. And there's even a more interesting thing about these amino acids. That of these amino acids, they are only a certain kind. You know, there was a study done by NASA, and this study basically was, if we're going to go look for life on another planet, what are we going to expect to find? And so they started doing these studies, and they found out that amino acids in living things are all left-handed. And what I mean by that is, you know, in chemistry, there's things called isomers. And isomers mean that, you know, like you have two hands, they're exactly the same, but you'll notice that your thumbs point at each other, so they're not right, right? They're the opposite. They point together. They're left-handed and right-handed. Well, the same thing happens with these amino acids. They're isomers. They have left- and right-handed varieties. Guess what? In living things on this planet, the amino acids that go into making the proteins are all left-handed. No right-handed, all left-handed. Even though there's right and left-handed, they're only left-handed. You know what? They don't know why that is. I think I do. So what we can do then is we can do a test. We can see if evolution is possible doing a very, 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 very simple test. We can see the probability of protein coming together just by choosing left-handed amino acids. We're not going to choose the right ones. We're not going to put them together in the right order, okay? We're just going to choose left-handed versus right-handed. We'll do that kind of experiment. We could do that. I'll show you how we could do it. You know how probability works, right? You take a coin. It's got two sides, left and right, or top and bottom, heads and tails. You flip it. You go like that. And then you can do probability with that. What's the chance of flipping a coin and getting a head? Well, the probability is 1/2. Now, what happens if you start adding people? Let's say I stood here and somebody else stood there, and we both flipped a coin, and we both went like that. What's the probability of both of us getting a head? Well, it's 1 chance in 4. Or if we had, now let's go down the bottom here. 40 people. Imagine I could line up 40 people right here, and I gave you all a quarter, and we all stood there, and we flipped our quarter, and we went like that. What would be the probability that 40 people flipping a quarter would all have heads on that one flip? Guess what it is? 1 chance in 3 trillion. That's pretty slim chance, isn't it? So what we can do then is we can apply this little experiment to making a protein. Let's let heads be a left-handed amino acid, because that's the kind it has to be. Let's let tails be a right-handed amino acid. And remember, when we flip the coins, every single one of them has to be left-handed or you don't get the protein, right? So let's try that. But now we need to know how many we need to flip. Well, when NASA did this study, they said, well, you know, if we're looking for the simplest kind of life that we could imagine, it would have to possess, now this is the best case, by the way, for evolution, no less than 124 different proteins made up of 420 properly arranged amino acids. Okay, so now we know 420 times 124 is the number of flips that we're going to do. So let's see what happens. What's the probability of forming 124 unique proteins out of 420 left-handed amino acids? Guess what it is? You ready? Dum, dum, dum. 1 chance in 10 to the 14,136. Now let me ask you a question. Is that a smaller probability than Dawkins? Is that a smaller probability than impossible? Yeah, I mean, it's like, what? You see, when scientists began looking at the probability of natural forces just randomly throwing together matter and through natural selection, random mutation in time, coming together and making a complex molecule, they began to look at the probabilities. They began saying, this is a problem. I did a simple experiment here. I mean, I want you to think about this. When you do the math, evolution is impossible, and they know it. If you do the math, evolution is impossible. You know, one of the things that I didn't mention was that out of those 20 amino acids that living things are made out of, those amino acids aren't just strung together randomly. They actually are specified in complexity, just like a web address. You have to have the exact one in the exact order. The probability of that is infinitely greater. So in other words, I was doing the easiest case you can possibly do using probability that I can understand with my simple brain. But some people have done these things with the more complicated brains. But you know what it means? It means that the chances of evolution ever happening is the same as if you could take a football and throw it to the moon with your arm. How many of you could do that? I'll give you 1 billion years to try. Okay? And you'll never get it done. You know, there was a man who wrote in a book called Information, The Origins of Life. He writes in his book, a physicist named Jay Morowitz calculates that the probability of a very tiny microbe, microplasma, Appearing spontaneously is one chance out of 10 raised to the 5 billionth power. Think about that. You know, his brain's bigger than mine, and he really looked at all the different things that had to happen right to make it happen. That number, come on. It's beyond impossible, right? And so, what does complexity teach us? See, doing this exercise is for a reason. Complexity teaches us something. Complexity now becomes an informational pathway. You can now, as a scientist, go over to the door and say, yea, verily, it was not an axe, it was an accident. You get it? You could, with complexity, you can come over and you could say, I can eliminate the possibility that this happened, and now I have to look for another possibility. And so what complexity does, it says, you can absolutely eliminate the possibility that evolution, Darwinian evolution or any other kind they're thinking of, was the reason for the origin of life on this planet. You get it? With scientific, using science, the tools of science, complexity tells us that now that's an informational pathway. We can throw out that as a theory because it just couldn't possibly happen. And so it points us to an intelligent cause. Ta-da! You see, this is exactly what that Bible text talked about. You should be able to see what God hid. And of course, now we can because we have the tools of science to do it. Robert Gage, PhD, writes in his book, he's a research field of cryophysics and information systems. He writes, the likelihood of life having occurred through a chemical accident is for all intents and purposes zero, 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 zero. So complex life requires what? A designer. You have to have a designer because guess what? Complexity tells me that that random junk that they've been feeding our school kids is not going to make it happen. We got to look for another source, another path. And of course, that is an intelligent designer. If you look at that thing right there, we are just touching on a few things here. But complexity, there's another kind of complexity. And this complexity was brought out by a man who named Michael Behe. He's a biochemist. He's also a microbiologist. And he's tenured. That's why they can't fire him. I found that out the first night. And what he did was, in the end of the 1990s, as evolution was rising in the schools because of the government, he was writing books about his discoveries of these incredibly small things he's been studying in microbiology. The book's called Darwin's Black Box. And in it, he came up with a further test of complexity. And here's his test. Darwin himself had this test. He said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. That's from his Origin of the Species. So, taking that as his test, Michael Behe then begins to unpack one right after another of things that falsify Darwin and show that his system completely breaks down. And it's called irreducibly complex systems. An irreducibly complex system cannot be produced by slight successive modification of a precursor system because any precursor to an irreducibly complex system that is missing a part is by definition non-functional. And so the example that he gives in his book is the example of a mousetrap. You know, you look at this mousetrap up here, in order for it to function, which piece can I remove and it still function? Which piece? Can I remove the spring? Can I remove the cheese? Can I remove the back plate? Can I remove anything? So, in other words, if you can understand this, you can understand irreducibly complex systems. That's a system where, in order for it to function, you have to have all the parts. And according to Michael Behe, you cannot have evolution. Darwin's test fails because there are tons of these little things all throughout our body. For example, the one he mentions is a flagellum, which is something that's inside your lungs and in various places. It's a little motor that has a little thing that whips around. You've got these things in you. And you can see right there, looks like a motor. It's got a stator. And if any part of that wasn't there, the whole thing wouldn't work. And so it wouldn't even function. Another, you know, a flagellum is on the order of a couple of microns. A micron's one 20,000ths of an inch. Most of its length is the propeller. The motor itself would be maybe 100,000ths of an inch. Even with all our technology, we can't even begin to create something like this. It's the most efficient motor on the planet. Another one, which you need, you cannot live without this one, is called ATP synthase molecule. And what that thing does is it takes food and turns it into energy for your body. It looks just like a motor. It says here that ATP is the basis of energy transport in all living organisms, not just us, but all of them. This little thing, this little motor here, is an irreducibly complex system. Johns Hopkins University writes that it's one of the most complex molecules ever revealed. 6 times larger than a blood molecule, hemoglobin, it's also, the researchers agree, one of the tiniest and most powerful motors ever identified. One piece was missing, the whole thing wouldn't work. It's an irreducibly complex system. And this one is probably the easiest for us to understand. You know, it's the one that he puts in his books called a bombardier beetle. It's you can see this in the macro, if you will, instead of these little micro things. It's a little bug that has a defense mechanism that's really interesting. It has a way of squirting a little hot thing at you. You know, it won't kill you, it won't hurt you, it won't cause itself to blow up or anything, but it's irritating. But here's how it works. He's got inside himself little glands that produce hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone. And you know, that's an amazing thing even of itself. And these two little glands then, when he's upset, they squirt that stuff out into collecting vessels. And then those collecting vessels squirt that stuff down into an explosion chamber, and of course, boom, out goes the stuff. And this is an example of an irreducibly complex system, because not one part of that could be missing and the thing work. This is the thing that falsifies Darwin's test. His theory is completely broken down. Michael Behe, when he came out with this, he just looked and says, "Hey, everybody." Think about that. He writes, "If a biological system cannot be produced gradually, it would have to arise as an integrated unit in one fell swoop." Okay, what model is that model? What model tells us that we were produced in one fell swoop? Creation. That's right, not evolution. And this guy's proven it. It's amazing. And let me share with you just a couple examples more of an irreducibly complex system, just so you'll get the idea. Flight is an irreducibly complex system. And I know this because I worked in that area for many years. When you have an aircraft, you have to have there are four things happening at all times. You have to have thrust to deal with the drag. You have to have lift to deal with the gravity. Those things have to happen. You have to have control surfaces in order for you to actually, when you're up in the air, to move around. You have to be able to control your pitch, your yaw, and your roll. And if you can't do those things, you can't fly. It's just simple as that. And so this is an irreducibly complex system because you have to have thrust, you have to have lift, you have to have these control systems, and you have to have them all together at the same time or you don't have flight. But yet we have the most amazing flight. You know, think about birds. Their wing shape is perfectly designed for lift. They even have specially designed feathers. They're called flight feathers. The surface area of every single bird, I don't care what bird it is exactly perfect for the lift it needs for the size of the bird. Every bird. Without question, if the bird flies, the surface area of its wing is exactly what it needs for lift. Who did that calculation? Unbelievable. And every single bird has specialized propulsion. They have specialized sockets that no other creature has that gives them the ability to pull those things back together like that and to create the lift that they need. Every single bird has control surfaces. Excuse me. If you wanted to capture a bird and keep it as your pet, all you got to do is take one of those control surfaces and clip it, and it will never fly. Even though it's got all that surface area, it will not fly because it can't control where it's going. So you have flight, you got to have all those things. It's an irreducibly complex system. Dr. Andrew McIntosh writes, a bird can fly only because it has an exceedingly light bone structure, which is achieved by the bones being hollow. Many birds maintain skeletal strength by cross members within hollow bones. Such an arrangement began to be used in the middle of this century, which would be the last century, for aircraft wings. It's called the Warren's Truss Arrangement. So not only do they have this specialized equipment, but their bone structure is specialized. It's in a little arrangement called a Warren's Truss Arrangement. Dr. Andrew McIntosh writes that if big birds tried to evolve these kind of things, they would never fly, because if there was some halfway skeletal stage, they basically would break in pieces in midair. They had to have it all at the same time. It's an irreducibly complex system. How about sexual reproduction? I'm not going to get into this, but I want to share with you that every single day of your life, you can ponder irreducibly complex systems. Sexual reproduction is an irreducibly complex system. It's a complex system. It depends on things that are, and when you think about it, for atheistic evolution, what would be the most efficient way for this little cell to morph and to keep spreading and growing and morphing? What would be the most efficient way? Asexually, right? This thing itself would reproduce itself, and then it would reproduce itself. But the Bible says that God made them male and female. Boy, that's a little hard for them. And so when you look at male and female, you're talking about very unique systems that have to come together exactly right, or you don't have a kid, or you don't have a child. It's irreducibly complex. Think about the animals, the male and the female, and some of the rituals and the specialized equipment that they have in order for that to occur. All of that is complex. And so what does it do? When you see complex things, instantly you say, okay, we can rule out all this random junk. There must have been a designer. Dr. Behe writes, it has attracted a lot of attention from people who have tried to knock it down, but they haven't been able to do it. Complex biological systems have yet to be explained by naturalistic means, that's by atheism, materialism. That's a fact. Even Darwinists admit that in their candid moments, and as science advances, we are continuing to find more and more complexity in the cellular world. So in other words, it's not getting better for them, it's getting worse. And it will be getting worse for them as science progresses. Okay, so complexity is one of the scientific tools that you can use every day of your life to see creation. The other one that I'd like for you to see is language. Language. Let's talk about that for a minute. You know, on our planet, right now, governments have spent, hundreds of millions of dollars building these dishes out in various parts of the world. And these dishes here are collecting radio frequencies. Okay? They're pointed out into space, and what they're looking for is Mr. E.T. out there. They're hoping that someday that they will see something come in that they can identify as having language. You know, one of the places where that happens is this SETI group, and they have something called the Allen Telescope Array Frequency. And one day in a magazine, they were asked, it was on space.com Thursday, they asked this man named Seth Sostak, he's the senior astronomer at the SETI Institute, they said, what are SETI scientists looking for? You know, what would prove that they found ET? And here's what he said. Perhaps the extraterrestrials will preface their message with a string of prime numbers. Or maybe the first 50 terms of the ever-popular Fibonacci series. Well, there's no doubt that such tags would convey intelligence. And that's what they're looking for. Now, if you look at what he's saying here, what he's really saying is this. He's looking for the language of mathematics. You see, mathematics is a language. You know, all languages have something in common. They have symbols, they have grammar, they have meaning, and they have intent. And if you've ever seen an equation, you know that there are symbols, There is grammar, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. There's meaning, 1 + 1 = 2, that's the meaning. And there's intent, 1 + 1 = 2, right? And so the point here is that mathematics is a language. In fact, mathematics is the language that basically is rebuilding the Tower of Babylon. It's the one thing that unites the whole world because it's a common language. But one of the things interesting about language is this. Language doesn't happen without intelligence. Let me give you an example. So we had a Scrabble table, and we were playing Scrabble for 1 billion years. Boy, would you get bored after 1 billion years of playing Scrabble? Okay, and so what we're going to do is we're going to do something different. We're going to build a little trebuchet, you know, a little launcher thingy, and we're going to dump all the little letters there, the symbols. We're going to put them in there and just launch them over here, and then they'll fall on the Scrabble table, splatter right there, and then we'll look for words. And we're going to do that for 1 billion years. Could get boring. But the point is that what we're going to see is, if we just used natural laws, which, you know, gravity is a natural law, right? And we just chuck those things up in the air, come down, splatter on the thing. If we did it 1 billion times, 1 billion years, whatever, I think eventually we might find an A next to a T or something like that, right? Well, that, maybe that's at. But if you were to run along somewhere and see this on the Scrabble table, would you think that that happened by an accident? Just some amazing dumb luck. You see, what this would show the person walking by, we would instantly say, no, an intelligent cause did that, because there are symbols, there's grammar, there's meaning, and there's intent. Ooh, that's language. And whenever you find language, you have found the intelligent source behind it. That had to have been an intelligent source. That wasn't an accident. That wasn't random chance. That was intentional. Well, friends, this thing that they discovered last century called DNA is exactly that. You know, DNA, which is in every cell of your body, which is what is the blueprint for how you're made, it's got this helix, it's got like this backbone, and between the backbone, you've got these four chemicals. You see them there. I'm not going to name them. I'm just going to call them A, T, G, and C. But those four chemicals are used just like the ones and zeros of a computer. And DNA is a language. DNA is the most efficient memory storage device ever existed. It's 6 feet long, 800 times larger than the cell that it's in. It's 3 billion letters, and a live reading of that code at a rate of 3 letters per second would take you 31 years, even if you continued reading day and night. That's from Francis Collins. The binary code that we have in our computers, you know, for example, this screen right up here comes from a computer. You're just seeing it directly from my computer. But underneath that computer is running a bunch of ones and zeros. That's making the pro. Underneath it, all down there, but then you see this at the top. This is the macro level, but underneath there in the micro level, you have all these ones and zeros. Well, the genetic code is exactly the same. The genetic code consists of these four different chemicals ordered in a certain way, you know, just across the screen, ordered in a certain way. You don't see them because they're in every cell of your body. You're the macro. They're the micro. And they make you run. Bill Gates, you know, he knows a lot about software. He writes in Lee Strobel's book, A Case for a Creator, that DNA is like a software program, only much more complex than anything that we've ever devised. You know, I'm going to share with you that if we had a space probe that went into deep space, you know, went into a black hole somewhere, and he came out the other side, and somewhere there was an intelligent, highly advanced civilization, and they found this thing. It ran out of batteries years ago. They took it and put it in their thing, but they found this hard drive. And on the hard drive, they found all these little ones and zeros, you know, highs and lows. And they studied it and studied it, and pretty soon they realized that was the code for some program. It had a language to it. It had symbols, grammar, meaning, and intent. And they would say, wow, this thing was made by another intelligence. We found another intelligence out there. Or say you took this cuneiform tablet that when scientists first discovered it, they looked like, well, you know, that looks like a kid that just poked mud with a stick. But pretty soon we realized that there's symbols in there, and there's grammar, and there's meaning and intent. And we said, whoa, there's a language. Guess what? There was people that actually made that, and intelligence did that. DNA is exactly the same thing. You know, there's a person named Peter Marshall who did sequencing of DNA. He says that DNA is an encoding-decoding mechanism that stores and transmits the message of a living organism. Biologists have actually been using linguistic analysis to decode the human genome. Tools that we must use to analyze languages are continually being used to figure out what all those genes actually mean, because we know it's a language. And when you have found language, what have you found? You have found the intelligent source behind it. Did you catch that? When you have found language, you have found intelligence. And guess what? In every cell of your body, there's evidence of intelligence that made it. Think about that. DNA is the thumbprint of creation. If complexity didn't get you, DNA has to get you. You know, I'm going to share with you that over a decade ago now, I think it was in 1999 or 2000. No, it had to have been 1999 because Bill Clinton was out of office in 2000, right? In about that time frame, these two men stood before the cameras. The man there in the back is Francis Collins. He was a guy that was the lead scientist in the people who basically sequenced the human genome. And Bill Clinton, of course, you know the guy in the front. The day was the announcement that they had completed their work. They now had sequenced the entire human genome. And Francis Collins just like any scientist, he was just, you know, his worldview was atheism. Okay? As he began this study and as he began looking at this, something changed in his mind. Something changed in his heart. Listen to what he writes, what they said. Bill Clinton standing there in front of the people. Today, we are learning the language in which God created life. We are gaining ever more awe for the complexity, the beauty, the wonder of God's most divine and sacred gift. That was the President of the United States. But guess what? He didn't write that. You know who wrote that? Francis Collins. He's got a book. It's called The Language of God. You need to get it. It's really interesting. He's still not where he needs to be, but now he's a theist. He's not an atheist. He's a theist. But in his book, he writes about this. He says, was I as a, you know, a rigorously trained scientist just trying to pander to the crowds? No. I wrote this as an act of worship to the God that I had just discovered. Think about that. He then said in his speech, he said, it is humbling for me and awe-inspiring to realize that we have caught the first glimpse of our own instruction book previously known only to God. You see, you can see creation by using science. And scientists have actually done it. And I've just shown it to you tonight. You have an awesome creator. Psalms 104:24, O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. So, friends, which one would you rather believe? Which one would you rather have as your worldview? Naturalistic philosophy, which is a guise for atheism, or creation? I'm going to share with you one more thing. Dr. William Dubinsky says this. Within naturalism, the intelligibility of the world must always remain a mystery. Within theism, on the other hand, anything other than an intelligible world would constitute a mystery. Dr. Stephen Myers, who has his PhD in the philosophy of science from Cambridge, where Darwin was originally, says, the origin of modern science was spawned by scientists who had precisely this sort of awe They were in the main Christians who believed that science was possible because nature was intelligible. It could be understood and comprehended by rational minds such as ourselves because it had been designed by a rational mind in the first place. That God put into nature order and design and discernible pattern, that's what made it possible to do the hard work of looking at all things and then eventually discerning that there was a pattern. Kepler said that scientists have the high calling of thinking God's thoughts after him. Design was part of the foundational assumption of modern science. Scientists assumed that nature was designed, and that's why they could do science. Now, roll the clock forward 300 years, and you have a scientist saying that if we allow a design hypothesis in any realm of science, even if we're talking about something like the origin of the first life, we are undermining the foundation of science. Then he says, in fact, we are getting back to the very foundation of science and to that awe and wonder that was the inspiration for the whole enterprise. And I believe that's true. Friends, where there is design, there is a designer. Well, God bless you all. I will see you next Friday at 7 p.m. where we are going to unpack the social impact of evolution on your life, your past, your present, and your future. So please be there, and God bless you all.